Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Joel Kotkin, Distinguished Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, an adjunct fellow with the Legatum Institute based in London, England, and the author of The City, A Global History, and The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Mr. Kotkin's remarks were given as the keynote address at the 2011 Economic Outlook Luncheon presented by the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is David Brown, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce.
It's my pleasure to introduce this internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends, Joel Kotkin. Joel's latest book, The Next 100 Million, America in 2050, explores how the nation will evolve in the next four decades, and it has received rave reviews across the world. Now, without further ado, I'm going to turn the program over to Joel Kotkin. Let's give him an Omaha welcome.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me here. I'd like to sort of go through a lot of material really quickly, and hopefully Dave and I will have a little chat. Hopefully I won't offend too many people. It's always interesting to go to this part of the country, which I have described as the zone of sanity, coming from my adopted home state of California, for which apparently Theodore Roosevelt is to say the problem with California is it's too small to be a country and too big to be an insane asylum. And as we were talking at the bank with some of the people at the table, we could certainly see that this is something that we have to deal with in California. And I thought the comment about capital will go where it meets the least resistance is very true. I was in Singapore last week, and I'll tell you, a lot of capital is flowing there. They have a good regulatory environment, relatively low taxation, and a very good infrastructure. And it's a great place for people to go. And I can think you can say much the same about Omaha and the Great Plains. Now, I'm basically an optimist about the United States. We seem to be working very hard to mess up a good situation. But our basic advantage is we have relatively good demographics. One of the great issues facing East Asia, for instance, Japan and Europe, is very, very low what we call fertility rates. Now, that is how many children do each individual woman have. In the United States, we're at about replacement rate, 2.1. In some of these other countries, we're looking at 1, 1.2. In many of the parts of East Asia now, we see about 40% of women in their 30s not being married. The chances of them having children are probably pretty slim. So demographics is a big advantage. We're the only advanced industrial country with a significantly growing population. Now, that population growth has slowed, and it could continue to slow down the road, but hopefully not. The other thing is that what's forgotten, and I'm going to stress this a great deal, is stuff matters. You know, we live in this information age, and everybody thinks, well, it's financial industry and the things like information technology that drive everything, and they do, except for one thing. They are amazingly porous, and they can move from place to place. Much harder to move food production, energy production, and even to some extent industrial production from one place to another. It's much more difficult, and so that stuff really matters fundamentally. This is one of the reasons why I think the Heartland A has done better over the last few years, having to do with lots of global factors, and also one of the reasons why the U.S. is in reasonably good shape. The question is whether or not we're going to do anything about it. I mean, I'm very worried that we're on the verge of a game-changing energy situation with oil and gas, and whether or not we'll take advantage of it. And that will be probably the most critical issue in the next few years. Now, the U.S. population basically is slated to grow to about 400 million. We're about 310 now. When President Kennedy was elected, we had about 200 million. So we've doubled the population of this country during the period over the last 50 years. That growth will continue. It will probably be somewhat slower but we're going to have relatively large population increases. And one of the things I've been working on is, where is that growth going to go? And I'll try to touch on that, if not now, when I'm talking with David. The big difference is age. In other words, if we could all have 310 million people and not add another person, probably be okay, except for one thing. The population would be so old that we couldn't get anything done. There would be, you sort of end up with not a lot of entrepreneurs, not a lot of innovation, not growing markets. And we're already seeing this happening in countries like Japan, where the population is aging so rapidly. A friend of mine went to Japan recently, and they said, I don't understand. How are these Americans having so many children? And so I told my friend, they said, well, you know what? If they got to ask that question, they're in more trouble than I thought. But you're looking at, we just did a paper for this for a think tank in London. In Germany and Japan, they will have by 2050, basically 50 retired people for every 100 who are working. This is not sustainable. And we actually believe, the work I'm doing now, that actually the numbers will be much worse than that, because so many people are not having any children, and the demographers haven't even put that into their equations yet. Now, this means, of course, having a stronger growth, you have a stronger labor force growth. And you need labor force growth to grow your markets, to grow your companies. In Japan, we're talking about a massive decrease in the labor force. I mean, literally, with their aging population, they're really talking about having to go to robots to take care of the elderly, because they don't really want immigrants. Korea is going through a somewhat similar thing, about 20 years behind. Singapore also about 20 years behind Japan. Europe's workforce is also going to be decreasing. So we have a great competitive advantage as a country. But the other big thing is we have tremendous resources. And I think one of the big problems in this country, and this is particularly true as newspapers have cut away their bureaus and they now are increasingly, you know, basically most of the news you're getting is being written by and decided by, you know, six 25-year-olds living in DuPont Circle or Brooklyn or part of San Francisco, you know, sharing a house, and their whole worldview is this little tiny world of theirs. So, of course, you know, Omaha doesn't even exist, you know, it's just something you fly over maybe. But actually, in the real world, it really matters to have stuff. The U.S. has tremendous arable land, the most arable land of any country, and that is an enormous long-term advantage. And one of the reasons it's such an advantage is that we not only have the land, but we have the water. The United States, North America, and my wife's Canadian, so I always got to talk about North America, is that we have about four times as much water per capita than Europe or Asia. If you spend time in China, even the bottled water is basically undrinkable. They are really headed towards a tremendous shortage of water over time. So the combination of having water and having the land is a huge advantage. So fundamentally, one of the reasons your agricultural economy is doing so well is there is a growing market for food and more high-value-added food. Like if you go to China today or Korea, there people are not satisfied with just having rice or maybe a little piece of pork. They're now eating meat much more. So when you get this tremendous increase in meat consumption, you get a tremendous demand for soybeans and other feed grains. And this goes through the whole system. I mean, I've even been in India where there are wine bars now. So what you're seeing is a tremendous growth in the demand fundamentally for the products, the agricultural products of the United States. And you see how farm exports have been going up. And I think we're just at the beginning of that trend. As long as the developing countries are moving up, there is a fantastic market and a fantastic growth opportunity for this part of the country. And then the most amazing thing has been this natural gas revolution. The next person who tells me about peak oil, I'm going to just say, well, you're talking about peak oil on Mars, because we have so much oil and gas in this country, and then if you add in Canada, that there is absolutely no reason why we should be importing any energy except maybe from Canada. It is insane to even think that we don't have it. Now, in my adopted home state of California, we probably have more oil and gas than anyone. We just won't use it. But I think other parts of the country are using it, and you're seeing tremendous boom that is taking place and a huge opportunity over time for the United States. And we're starting to see this with manufacturing. And I think what you're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years is companies in Germany and Japan, where the markets are shrinking, where the labor force is shrinking. In the case of Japan, they barely have the electricity to run their industrial plant now anyway, that they're going to be looking more and more at the U.S., and particularly places like the Great Plains in the Mid-South for their industrial expansions. And with a greater understanding by many of them that it's much safer to bring your technology to Omaha than to bring it to Chengdu. Because if you bring it to China, it's not going to be yours very long. So I think there's a lot of positives on the manufacturing front. Now, how about in terms of population? And where is population going? You know, we always hear that the population and the growth in the country is going to take place in the mega cities on the coast. And, of course, unemployment is a huge consideration. Obviously, the Great Plains already are enjoying about the most robust employment situation in the country. And as you can see here, Omaha actually had fairly good growth. It grew almost at the level of some of the Texas places, but it grew far better than obviously many of the places on the either coast, which have actually lost their job base. Silicon Valley, here's an interesting thing. Silicon Valley now has 25% fewer tech jobs than it had a decade ago. So one of these things that nobody seems to pay attention to. We look at STEM jobs again, Nebraska being above the national average, California well below the national average. So yes, we have the installed base, as does Massachusetts, of STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, mathematics-related employment, but the trend is to other regions of the country, including to the Great Plains. This is a really interesting map because what it shows is income growth. Because people say, well, all right, you know, all those, maybe they have jobs, but they don't pay very well, and people are really poor in that part of the country. You can see basically that most of the income growth in the United States has been concentrated in this, what you would call zone of sanity, which is basically starts in North Dakota and goes through Texas. So this part of the country is also getting richer. It's getting richer faster than the rest of the country. Then where are people moving? Well, people aren't stupid. I mean, the newspapers may think they're stupid, and the news media may think they're stupid, but people really aren't that stupid. And what we're seeing is they're beginning to move to smaller regions. By the way, this is a global trend. We're seeing this in India, we're seeing it in China, that people are beginning to say, you know what, I can get the amenities, the things I'm interested in a city of 500,000, a million, 2 million, that I can get in a city of 8 to 10 million without the congestion, without the high prices. So there's been a movement since 2000 pretty consistently that people are moving to smaller cities. So an area like this one is very, very ideal in the current economy because many people are looking for places that they can afford to live in, where housing costs are cheaper, where the quality of life is higher, and where, this is the important point, where the middle class quality of life is achievable by a large number of people. That is probably your greatest single advantage. So what we're now seeing is after years and years in which net migration was leaving the Great Plains, most Great Plains cities now have positive net migration. This is something that has been almost completely ignored in the national media and is a major change after decades in which you were losing your best and brightest and your young people to other places. Now that situation is reversing. Now, housing affordability is a huge part. Now, this measurement is basically median price house, median price family income. So you can't say, well, San Francisco houses are more expensive, but incomes are higher. This is actually controlled for that. So we know for that basically it takes much, well, like 2.6 here in Omaha, 2.6 years of income to buy a house, and in San Francisco it costs 7. So that's a big difference, particularly for younger people trying to get into the market. We know that young people, college graduates, are moving to places that are more affordable. This is something that is also almost completely ignored. We also know that they are going to places that are less dense. The reality is, no matter what the new urbanists and others suggest, the vast majority of people want to live in a single-family house with a backyard. And when that is not affordable, people will go to other places. And this is exactly what's happening in terms of migration flows, when we start looking at what happens to people when they get into their 30s. This one you might like a lot. This is where people are coming and going to Omaha. Now, you're still losing population to Florida and Texas. I don't know why you'd lose population to Florida. It maybe has something to do with the weather. But where you are seeing your gains, I think it's really interesting. You have huge net migration from California and significant net migration from the St. Louis area and significant net migration from the New York area. So what we're seeing is this whole idea that everybody's moving to the big, hip, cool cities is just not true. That places like Omaha are beginning to become more and more attractive. And we think this really is particularly true as people get into their 30s, they want to buy a house, they want to start a business, they want to build a career, and then they also want to have children, you know, children, which, you know, some people actually want to do. So what do I get from this in terms of your regional strategy? One thing, you have to have a regional strategy based on who you are. You can't have a regional strategy based on who you might want to be. And I think one of the big problems with a lot of cities is that they keep trying to be San Francisco or something else, and it's never going to happen. You know, like this is I don't know if you remember Jennifer Granholm, the governor of Michigan. I always found her to be just amusing. And she had this hip, cool cities, you know, hip Flint, cool Kalamazoo, all that. Well, it really worked, as we can tell. One of the radio hosts said to me, well, if you need a campaign to prove you're hip and cool, you're not. And that was some of the sort of misunderstanding of what really matters to people over time. So what are the main things that you have going for you here in Omaha? One, the strong appeal of families and the educated young. That is really important. Not necessarily in their 20s, but in their 30s. As they start to form a family, as they start to make long-term decisions about buying a house, about having kids, about looking for a school district, your appeal will grow more and more in that kind of context. Low density, people. There's always going to be and should be a market of people who really like very dense urban living. And maybe downtown Omaha was about 5,000 now, maybe it'll be 10,000 in 10 years, and that would be great. But you're talking about 10,000 in a population of, let's say, 1 million. So fundamentally, what you're seeing is most people prefer this kind of living. You know, when I was, my translator on my books came from Korea, and she came over to my house, little 2,300 square foot, sort of somewhat dilapidated ranch house in Los Angeles, and she said, I can't believe this. Only the president of Hyundai lives like this. Well, believe me, I'm not the president of Hyundai. And, you know, probably 80% of the people in Omaha live at that level. I think the key commodity market connection is going to become more important over time. Again, we're in a very different world in terms of energy and food because of the entrance of the developing countries, India, China, Southeast Asia, South America, all on the way up, all increasing their income, all wanting to use more energy. This is a huge opportunity for this part of the country. And then you have a good cost structure. You know, again, the competitive aspects of coming in. I mean, you can't compete if you're California to try to bring somebody in, let's say, with a manufacturing plant or even in the case of back office support. What we see in Silicon Valley is huge parts of Silicon Valley are now expanding into Salt Lake and other places where they can get labor at lower rates and where their basic costs like energy are much less. So at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is Omaha works. What you're doing works. You just want to become better at what you do, understand where you are. The natural forces that are shaping the world economy are in your favor, and it's up to you to take advantage of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joel. We're going to have a chance for a couple of quick questions. Last night, Joel and I had an opportunity to share a dinner, and one of the interesting points that Joel made was the discussion about Singapore. And it's not a target on our international marketing program, and so we were talking a bit about how Singapore is full of investors and that there's an opportunity for More growth in the Midwest as a result. I wonder if you could elaborate that out a bit.
Well, one of the things that's happened with Singapore is I have a very close relationship with the people there. One of the things is that Singapore is completely English-speaking, so it's very easy to go there. It is the only place in the world that is equally connected with the English-speaking world, the Chinese-speaking world, and the Indian world, the three dominant spheres in the world economy today. And because it has the rule of law, and because Hong Kong has essentially been absorbed into China, more and more investors are going there. There's a very good investment climate, about 18.5% income tax. They have very good financial security laws. And so it's a very good place. And so I was chatting with some of my colleagues there, and I was saying, they said, what's going on in the U.S.? And I said, it's not one country. It's a lot of different countries with very different situations. And I was talking about the project I'm doing on the Great Plains for Texas Tech. And I was saying, there is this whole huge part of the U.S., this zone of sanity, which has tremendously good opportunities for investors. They said, we don't know about that. We look at America as New York tells us or Washington tells us, reports about the whole country. And somehow I felt like, maybe we ought to do something where we talk about the zone of sanity and the other growth corridors. I'm working on a project for the Manhattan Institute on what are the future growth corridors, and this is one of them, in the next 40 years. And somehow that story should be communicated both with our own financial community, but particularly in places like Singapore and Dubai, where a lot of the world's capital is now gathered.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about Secretary Geithner today talked a bit about where growth is going to happen in this country, and they always seem to forget the Midwest is there. Last night you mentioned some, too, about us kind of living under a bushel basket a bit. People just don't know much about the Midwest. What do you think we can do to get our word out there better?
Well, one thing is you cannot trust having spent my life working for the Northeastern media, I can tell you cannot trust them to tell your story, okay? You're going to have to use social media. You're going to have to use the Internet. You're going to have to make your own presence felt. There is a great opportunity for those parts of the country that have been largely voiceless to now get their message across. And I don't think you need expensive advertising campaigns, but I think there are ways that you can let people know. I can tell you, because I've also dealt with this from the other end in interior China and in cities like Chengdu, how do they get people in the U.S. to understand that Chengdu is a place with great opportunities for business to invest in China? So I just think you're going to need to get that message out in a coherent way. And you know what? The numbers will tell you the story. The migration numbers, the growth numbers, the income numbers, the employment numbers. They're all on your side. You just haven't put it together into a coherent package so people can do it. And I would very strongly suggest that you do it as a region, as the Great Plains in general, not just one against another, because it becomes very confusing to the people in let's say Singapore or other parts of Asia, that they don't really know what the distinctions are. But I think that there's a great opportunity. Everybody there understands the importance of food, the importance of energy, the importance of land, and the importance of a good business climate.
Joel, thank you very much.
Thank
Let's
you.
Give Joel a round of applause
thank
for
you.
His remarks. Joel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Joel Kotkin, Distinguished Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, an adjunct fellow with the Legatum Institute based in London, England, and the author of The City, A Global History, and The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Mr. Kotkin's remarks were given as the keynote address at the 2011 Economic Outlook Luncheon presented by the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, Senior Special Events Coordinator for the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.